Greetings. This is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, June 20th, 2025. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with an article headlined "Paint by Numbers" by Bob Asmussen. Out of Champaign, Butkus the turf tank lines the majority of Illinois' athletic fields flawlessly. Movies and television are dotted with cool robot names. R2-D2 from Star Wars, Wall-E, Optimus Prime from Transformers, and Rosie from The Jetsons. Closer to home and in real life, Dan Thomas is getting in on the robot fun. Thomas, the superintendent of grounds for University of Illinois Athletics, is in charge of Butkus, the turf tank robotic field painter named to honor the Illini and Chicago Bears linebacker legend. The leased machine, with a price tag of about $15,000 annually, paints every field on the athletic campus: soccer, baseball, football, softball, track. If it needs to be marked, Butkus will do it perfectly. Turf Tank is a Denmark-based company with U.S. headquarters in Marietta, Georgia. Fun fact from Turf Tank: one of its first prototypes was built with Legos, the product of another Danish company. Thomas was first introduced to Turf Tank during his previous job in Major League Baseball. He also used it to paint the Tampa Bay Bucks lines and logos. "I saw it do its job, and I was like, 'Wow, this is really something,'" Thomas said. When he joined the Illinois Athletic Department in 2021, Thomas crunched the numbers and realized Turf Tank could really help us out here. Illinois has a 4-year deal with the company that includes all the needed materials and parts. At the end of that lease, we will either re-up or get a new, different model," Thomas said. Thomas, who understands the old ways of doing things continue to change, tries to stay on the cutting edge of technology. Next venture: adding a drone to scan the grass and help determine turf health. Task at hand: Butkus includes a computer software program. Thomas tells it what he wants, and Butkus goes to work. "It will paint it on the fields," Thomas said. "It is very accurate. If Coach Brett Bielema wants to look out his window and see straight lines, that's what we're going to do. Best part, it is lickety-split. Butkus can paint a whole field in 2 hours or less. The old ways of painting fields with string lines and manual push paint machines would take 5 workers 6 to 8 hours to complete. Butkus can paint a soccer field in 24 minutes. Thomas pulls Butkus on a trailer attached to his utility vehicle. At the field, Thomas puts his computer on base station, and it communicates with satellites in space, which provide GPS coordinates, and Butkus gets rolling. Butkus saves the department on paint cost and labor. Interestingly, Butkus isn't needed inside the Legends' former smashing grounds, Memorial Stadium. The lines on the turf are stitched in. Each Monday in the fall, Butkus is out and about painting soccer and football fields. Has Butkus ever gone wild, like painting a giant M instead of a block I? So far, no. "He has not misbehaved on me yet," Thomas said. "But I've heard stories of other people that have them, that occasionally a gust of wind will knock the base station over and will throw the satellites off. Now the robot is confused as to where to go. Then it will start doing some crazy stuff." Thomas stays at the field while Butkus is at work, which should make an accidental painting unlikely. Butkus is the only named piece of equipment in the Illinois tool shed, located on the southwest corner at Memorial Stadium. The Butkus reference is lost on some of the teams visiting campus. While Butkus is one of the iconic names in football, it isn't as recognizable to softball or track teams. They'll see the robot painting before a game and say, "What's its name?" And I'll say, "Butkus," and they'll kind of look at me cross-eyed. Thomas will continue to explain to more blank stares. "Not everybody knows Dick Butkus," Thomas said. It took a second for Thomas to get the new machine a moniker. "The first time I had it out was at football, and somebody said, You've got to name that thing. It's bad luck to have a robot without a name. Thomas looked around, saw the Butkus statue near the Smith Center, and knew he had the perfect name. Now everybody that sees it out and about knows it is Butkus, Thomas said. The name isn't written on the side of the turf, which technically belongs to the Danish company. But the machine is wrapped in school colors, orange and blue, with an orange block eye on the front. Standard turf tanks come in lime green, which might work for Oregon, but not Illinois. I've been told to put Butkus's football number on there, Thomas said. So look for number 50 to appear on the machine soon. I suggested Thomas consider a social media account for Butkus, similar to Sue the T-Rex at Chicago's Field Museum. He is open to the idea. Origin story. Thomas, 43, is in charge of all the Illinois athletic fields and surrounding areas. That's a lot of real estate. His crew includes six others who maintain the program's facilities. Thomas was born and raised in Lincoln. I grew up an Illini fan, went to the football games when I was a kid, he said. He played sports as a kid, but realized he wasn't going to be a pro athlete. Wanting to stay involved in sports, he put his green thumb to use. Thomas attended Lincoln College, where he earned his bachelor's degree in sports management. He next went to Ohio State University for certification in turf grass management. Thomas initially worked in minor league baseball, including Peoria with the Chiefs. Eventually, he worked his way up to becoming head of grounds management for the Baltimore Orioles spring training facility in Sarasota, Florida. He was there for 14 years. Thomas is coming up on his fourth anniversary at Illinois. Dan and his wife, Alexis, have two daughters, Giselle, 12, and Willow, 1. And moving over to the next front page story. REO Speedwagon, taking the stage against cancer. Bassist had son's doctor join group at the concert. Story by Joey Wright, out of Champaign. REO Speedwagon's last hurrah drew an energetic crowd at State Farm Center last weekend. Dr. Patrick Hui, HWU, hopes that same energy can be applied to the fight against cancer, particularly those that are difficult to talk about. I think there's still room for improvement, Hui said. The more we can talk about these things and normalize these discussions, the better. The director and CEO of Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida, helped treat Tommy Dallenbach after his diagnosis with testicular cancer. Dallenbach, the son of REO Speedwagon bass guitarist Bruce Hall, eventually rebounded from his brush with cancer, thanks in part to early detection and honest conversations. To have people being treated by our institution and have great outcomes like Tommy's, and for them to now have a growing family, there's nothing more fulfilling for us, Hu said. Hu joined MCs Mike Haley and L.A. Frederickson on stage before Hall performed alongside Neil Doty, Alan Gratzer, Terry Luttrell, Mike Murphy, and Steve Scorfina. His passion for treating and hopefully someday curing cancer was evident as he tossed silicon wristbands into the crowd before the music started. I don't think he ever imagined that he would do something like this, Halley said. It was very cool. He's a phenomenal guy. Hu was initially equally excited to share the stage with several members of REO Speedwagon. I've always loved this band, Hu said. The fact that we have a connection with this band and that we have a connection through the institution that I run, it's extra thrilling. Next story on the front page is Downtown Champaign. Blind Pig Brew Pub eyeing next week for soft opening. Story by Jana Wiersema, out of Champaign. As warmer weather and events on the new plaza draw people downtown, some are keeping a close eye on a new bar under development in the long-vacant former Destill space. We have to clean the windows again because of all the faces being pressed against it, joked Joe Bonilla, general manager of Blind Pig Brew Pub at 301 North Neal Street. Fans and curious passers-by may not have much longer to wait, as owner Matt Monahan said the business could potentially begin its soft opening period mid to late next week if all goes well with the licensing process. The plan is to have an extended soft opening, which Monahan said might last about a month. He gave a rough estimate of late July for the grand opening. That's going to allow us to train up everyone, he said, adding that we'll also provide time to keep developing the menu and work out any issues with online orders or delivery. The brew pub has received its permit from the health department and is very close to getting its city liquor license and certificate of occupancy, Monahan said. He noted that the business will also need a state brew pub license to transfer Blind Pig's beers from its Market Street brewery to the pub. Otherwise, we'd have to buy it from our distributor, which would defeat the purpose, he said. Other items on the to-do list include putting up signage, adding some finishing touches inside, and hiring staff. I think it's going to go well, Monahan said. We're just anxious to get going and allow things to be in our hands, as I have a lot of faith in the crew that we've got here and the people that I think we're anticipating bringing on board to bring this place to life like we want. Bonilla likewise said that the team looks forward to bringing the community into a space that has been vacant for 5 years and showing off the changes, along with Blind Pig's beers, of course. We're just ready to open, he said. And the final note on the front page is a nice picture from A Ride in the Royal Carriage. The reigning Miss Juneteenth, Gabrielle Schaefer, rides in Thursday's Urbana Parade commemorating the formal end of slavery in the U.S. in 1865. She was to pass on the title and crown to a successor Thursday evening. And then there's additional Juneteenth photo coverage on newsgazette.com. And it's a nice picture of her riding in a red convertible and carrying an American flag that's been stylized for Juneteenth. That's very cool. Moving now to national and world news. Mideast conflict. Will U.S. join war? 2 weeks. That's how long President Trump says it'll take him to decide on military involvement versus Iran. Story by Sam Mednick, Natalie Meltzer, and John Gambrell of the Associated Press. Out of Beersheba, Israel. Israel and Iran exchanged more attacks on Thursday as U.S. President Donald Trump said he would make up his mind within 2 weeks on whether the U.S. military will get directly involved in the conflict, seeking to keep open the door to diplomacy on Tehran's nuclear program. Based on the fact that there's a substantial chance of negotiations that may or may not take place with Iran in the near future, I will make my decision whether or not to go within the next 2 weeks, Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, told reporters, reading out Trump's statement. Trump has been weighing whether to attack Iran by striking its well-defended Fordo uranium enrichment facility, which is buried under a mountain and widely considered to be out of reach of all but America's bunker buster bombs. Earlier in the day, Israel's defense minister threatened Iran's supreme leader after Iranian missiles crashed into a major hospital in southern Israel and hit residential buildings near Tel Aviv, wounding at least 240 people. As rescuers wheeled patients out of the smoldering hospital, Israeli warplanes launched their latest attack on Iran's nuclear program. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz blamed Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei for Thursday's barrage and said the military has been instructed and knows that in order to achieve all of its goals, this man absolutely should not continue to exist. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he trusted that Trump would do what's best for America. I can tell you that they're already helping a lot, Netanyahu said, from the rubble and shattered glass around the Soroka Medical Center in Israel's southern city of Beersheba. The open conflict between Israel and Iran erupted last Friday with a surprise wave of Israeli airstrikes targeting nuclear and military sites, top generals, and nuclear scientists. At least 639 people, including 263 civilians, have been killed in Iran, and more than 1,300 wounded, according to a Washington-based Iranian human rights group. Israel has retaliated by firing 450 missiles and 1,000 drones at Israel, according to Israeli army estimates. Most have been shot down by Israel's multi-tiered air defenses, but at least 24 people in Israel have been killed and hundreds wounded. Israel's Home Front Command said one of the Iranian ballistic missiles fired Thursday morning had been rigged with fragmenting cluster munitions. Rather than a conventional warhead, a cluster munition warhead carries dozens of submunitions that can explode on impact, showering small bomblets around a large area and posing major safety risks on the ground. The Israeli military did not say where that missile had been fired. At least 80 patients and medical workers were wounded in the strike on Israel's Soroka Medical Center. The vast majority were lightly wounded, as much of the hospital building had been evacuated in recent days. Iranian officials insisted that they had not sought to strike the hospital and claimed the attack hit a facility belonging to the Israeli military's elite technological unit called C4I. The website for the Gav Yam Negev Advanced Technologies Park, some 2 miles from the hospital, said C4I had a branch campus in the area. The Israeli army did not respond to a request for comment. An Israeli military official, speaking on condition of anonymity in line with regulations, acknowledged that there was no specific intelligence that Iran had planned to target the hospital. Many hospitals in Israel, including Soroka, had activated emergency plans in the past week. They converted parking garages to wards and transferred vulnerable patients underground. Israel also has a fortified subterranean blood bank that kicked into action after Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack ignited the ongoing war in the Gaza Strip. Doctors at Soroka said the Iranian missile struck almost immediately after air raid sirens went off, causing an explosion that could be heard from a safe room. The strike inflicted the greatest damage on an old surgery building and affected key infrastructure, including gas, water, and air conditioning systems, the medical center said. Continuing on for national and world news, Hurricane Eric. Acapulco dodges worst as storm fades upon landfall. Out of Acapulco, Mexico, and the AP. Powerful Hurricane Eric made landfall in Mexico's southern state of Oaxaca earlier Thursday as a major hurricane before moving inland and weakening to a tropical storm as it dumped heavy rain, the National Hurricane Center in Miami said. The hurricane center was located about 35 miles north-northeast of Acapulco on Thursday afternoon. Its maximum sustained winds were clocked at 50 miles per hour. It was moving northwest at 12 miles per hour, the hurricane center said. The storm was downgraded slightly before making landfall from a powerful Category 4 to a Category 3. The storm threaded the needle between the resorts of Acapulco and Puerto Escondido, tearing into a sparsely populated stretch of coastline near the border of Oaxaca and Guerrero states. Agricultural fields blanket the low-lying coastal land between small fishing villages. Eric weakened rapidly as it crashed into the coastal mountains of southern Mexico, and the system was likely to dissipate late Thursday or early today, the Hurricane Center said. The storm threatened to unleash destructive winds near where the eye crashes ashore, flash floods, and a dangerous storm surge, forecasters said. South on approach. At first, light Thursday, Acapulco awoke under ominous dark clouds. Rain started earlier in the morning than with the arrival of stronger winds. There was light traffic on the streets. Some residents shopped in the few open stores, fishermen went to the shore to check their boats, and a few people took advantage of the calm for a quick swim. However, the storm moved northwest just inland up the coast through midday, bringing heavy rain to the resort and the mountains that tower dramatically above it. Still, it appeared Acapulco had dodged the worst, at least in terms of Eric's strong winds. Late Wednesday, Eric's projected path had crept south, closer to the resort city of Puerto Escondido in Oaxaca State, with Acapulco up the coast to the northwest. No injuries reported. President Claudia Sheinbaum said Thursday, "The people have reacted very well so far." National Civil Defense Coordinator Laura Velasquez said Thursday that at the moment there were no reports of injuries. Water entered a public hospital in the Oaxaca resort of Hualtelco, and there were hidden fallen trees, cuts to power, and landslides blocking highways. But authorities warned the heavy rain would now become the problem. Forecasters expected Eric to lash Mexico's Pacific coast with heavy rain, strong winds, and a fierce storm surge. Rains of up to 16 inches could fall across the Mexican states of Oaxaca and Guerrero, with lesser totals in Chiapas, Michoacán, Colima, and Jalisco states, the center's advisory said. The rainfall threatened flooding and mudslides, especially in areas with steep terrain. Guerrero Governor Evelyn Salgado urged residents of her state Thursday to not grow complacent after Eric made landfall in neighboring Oaxaca. "In Guerrero, we continue on maximum alert. Eric is still a danger with the intense rains. It could drop on our state in the coming hours," she said. And continuing in news and national and world news, we have Juneteenth. Celebrations across U.S. commemorate slavery's end. Out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and the AP. Juneteenth celebrations unfolded across the U.S. on Thursday, marking the day in 1865 when Union soldiers brought the news of freedom to enslaved Black people in Texas, and attracting participants who said current events strengthened their resolve to be heard. The holiday has been celebrated by Black Americans for generations, but became more widely observed after being designated a federal holiday in 2021 by former President Joe Biden, who was expected to attend an event in Galveston, the holiday's birthplace. The celebrations come as President Donald Trump's administration has worked to ban diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, or DEI, in the federal government, and remove content about Black American history from federal websites. Trump's travel ban on visitors from select countries has also led to bitter national debate. In Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Robert Reed waved a large Juneteenth flag at the city's African Burying Ground Memorial Park, where African drummers and dancers led the crowd in song and dance. Reed, 60, said he attended in part to stand against what he called Trump's divide-and-conquer approach. "It's time for people to get pulled together instead of separated," he said. Jordan Sarapuru, 18, visiting New Hampshire from California, called the large turnout a beautiful thing. "It's nice to be celebrated every once in a while, especially in the political climate right now," she said. "With the offensive things going on right now, with brown people in the country and a lot of people being put at risk for just existing, having celebrations like this is really important." The holiday to mark the end of slavery in the U.S. goes back to an order issued on June 19, 1865, as Union troops arrived in Galveston at the end of the Civil War. General Order No. 3 declared that all enslaved people in the state were free and had absolute equality. Juneteenth is recognized at least as an observance in every state, and nearly 30 states and Washington, D.C. have designated it as a permanent paid or legal holiday through legislative or executive action. In Virginia, a ceremonial groundbreaking was held for rebuilding the First Baptist Church in Williamsburg, one of the nation's oldest Black churches. Moving over to our communities, severe weather. Power restored, debris cleaned up in Rantoul. Story by Dave Hinton. out of Rantoul. Electrical service that was knocked out by strong winds that swept through Rantoul early Wednesday afternoon was restored by about 6 p.m., village administrator Scott Eisenhower estimated. The storm, believed to have been packing straight-line winds, swept in from the west and downed power poles, limbs, and in some cases, entire trees. We're extremely grateful for the electrical division, street division, and all our other employees jumping in and getting the community up and going, Eisenhower said. Crews cleaned up limbs and trees blocking sideways and undertook general cleanup. Police Chief Tony Brown, however, said Murray Road on the west side of town remains closed for work on power lines. Village residents and businesses are serviced by the municipal-operated electrical system. The storm, which hit about 1 p.m., damaged the Rantoul Family Sports Complex just east of Interstate 57. Soccer netting, temporary fencing, batting cages, and a scoreboard were damaged. The sports complex crew did an amazing job, Eisenhower said. They got out, they got everything all cleaned up, not just the baseball and softball fields, they got all the soccer area cleaned up as well. A baseball-softball tournament on Thursday was able to proceed as scheduled. The next soccer matches are on tap for Sunday. Eisenhower said the storm appeared to head from the sports complex east down Broadmeadow Road towards Village Hall in the middle of town, and then east along U.S. 136. And another story from our communities. Chicago City Council. Alderman pledges to fight mayor's vowed teen curfew veto. Won't twist arms. By Jake Sheridan out of the Chicago Tribune, TNS. Chicago. As Mayor Brandon Johnson promises to veto the teen curfew ordinance passed by aldermen, the measure's lead sponsor says he will keep fighting to make it law. Alderman Brian Hopkins, second, won out over Johnson in the city council on Wednesday when his plan to give Chicago's police superintendent power to declare teen curfews anytime, anywhere passed on a 27-22 vote. But his victory could be fleeting. Johnson quickly pledged to cast a rare mayoral veto, the city's first since 2006. The planned move means Hopkins must garner votes from 34 aldermen to overrule the mayor, a high bar that would require him to flip as many as 7 council members. Still, Hopkins said Thursday morning he would move ahead in July with a city council vote on Johnson's anticipated veto. He plans to keep making the case for his ordinance, but added that he will not be heavy-handed. I'm going to keep pushing back on the deceptive spin, but I'm not going to call my colleagues and twist arms. Everyone is going to vote their conscience on this, the downtown alderman said. The Wednesday vote and veto pledge marked decisive steps in Hopkins' 2-year push to give police more power to curb the so-called teen takeover youth gatherings that have sometimes ended in high-profile violence, including 2 Streeterville shootings in Hopkins' ward in recent months. And we're going to take a short break now and return with the second half hour of your News Gazette, dated Friday, June 20th, 2025. And we'll looking forward to hearing from you soon. Reading for you soon. Okay, bye.